Hey there, this is Rox, and you are listening to Murderverse, True Crime Hub. Quick disclaimer, this podcast may contain raw and sensitive material, so please come in with an open mind. It's a giant murderverse out there, and today's episode is on the cold-blooded shooting committed by Diane Downs that shocked and horrified the metropolitan city of Springfield, Oregon. Diane Downs was born Elizabeth Diane Fredrickson in Phoenix, Arizona on August 7, 1955. Her parents were Wesley Linden and Waladine Fredrickson. Diane attended and graduated from Moon Valley High School, where she met future husband Steve Downs, and then enrolled at Pacific Coast Baptist Bible College in Orange, California, where she was expelled after only a year for her promiscuous behavior. So Diane later claims that her lustfulness must have been due to the abuse she suffered at the hands of her father at the tender age of 12. Once expelled, she returned to Arizona and moved back in with her parents. This actually became a common trend throughout her life anytime she faced any misfortune. So eventually, she ran away from home as she couldn't maintain a healthy relationship with her parents and married Steve Downs on November 13th, 1973. It almost seemed as though Steve was a scapegoat she needed to ensure that she could stay out of her parents' home, and it was almost impulsive even. They had their first baby, Christy Ann, the following year, followed by Cheryl Lynn in 1976. So the marriage didn't last very long. Steve and Diane divorced in 1979 when Steve began to feel as though their third and youngest child, Stephen Daniel, who was born in 1976, was the product of an affair Diane had. Diane enjoyed the attention she got from being pregnant so much that she became a surrogate mother. She gave birth to a fourth child that she named Jennifer in 1982 and turned her into her intended parents, which was a relief to some who believed that Diane would not follow through with that part of the agreement. She later became employed with the U.S. Postal Service alongside her father. So let's actually get started talking about the murder.
Somebody needs help out there. Listen to him.
Shelby? Shelby, let's go. Mark.
What is it?
Someone just shot my kids. There's blood.
Mark! Mark!
Oh. Judy, call a code. It's bad.
I was trying to get help. I was leaning on the horn. I couldn't move. I just couldn't make my legs move.
What's going on?
These kids have been shot. Might have followed us. You better call the police. Somebody get some help!
It's May 19th, 1983. Diane pulls up to the hospital. She's frantically screaming that her children have been shot, along with bits and pieces of what happened, or what she says happened. At first glance, she looks like a frightened mother. She looks like she's concerned about her children's well-being. The children are bleeding profusely as they're rolled into the hospital and in palpable critical condition. At this point, there are no questions asked. The ER team simply take them in as fast as they can. They are giving her the benefit of the doubt. They're taking into consideration the sense of urgency that Diane seems to have. Diane is in the hospital repeating that she needs to see her children. She needed to see if they would, quote unquote, wake up. The hospitalists were trying to calm her down, but for some reason she kept repeating that her kids were attacked. The police finally arrive at the hospital, and it was her father who convinces her to accompany them to the scene of the crime. Police insist that it's time sensitive and that it is crucial so that they find the shooter. Her father leads her to the parking garage, where her tone completely changes and she is no longer in this state of frenzy. She then comments to one of the detectives. She says, "Is my car okay?" referring to the possible bullet holes that may have caused damage to the vehicle. She goes on to say, "It's brand new. I hope it doesn't have any bullet holes in it." She was told not to worry about her car, and her response was, "I wasn't just going to let him have it. It's brand new." Red flags, if there ever was one. Diane seems to remember every single detail of her day, from breakfast with her mother to the time that she got off of work to pick up her kids. Now, most parents, myself included, would be turned upside down if anything remotely painful happened to them. I wouldn't even have the brain capacity to think of anything else but my children and their medical attention being of greatest importance. Please excuse my language, but fuck my car and fuck going anywhere without knowing 100% that my children are okay. I mean, wouldn't you agree? While all of this is going on, Christy has suffered a stroke, poor Cheryl has passed away upon arrival, and Danny was fighting for his life with a bullet lodged dangerously near his spine. So, going back to the cop car, Diane has this serious case of word vomit. No one has even asked her a question yet, and she's going on about how happy she and the children were, how Cheryl's favorite song is Hungry Like the Wolf by Duran Duran, and that they were playing it in the car at the time of the incident.
Hi. What's your problem?
I want your car.
You gotta be kidding.
She went on to say that she and her children have made it a routine to go on small rides and sightsee. She said it was very late and she could hardly see anything. She mentions that it was late enough to where her children end up falling asleep. Diane then decides to take a detour down a street that she's unfamiliar with, and a man begins to wave her down, and like any good citizen, of course, with her sleeping children in tow, she stops to see if he needs any help. She says she takes the keys out of the ignition in case Danny were to wake up because she didn't want him to switch gears by accident. This makes absolutely no sense, as it would impair her from getting away safely if the stranger were to turn out to be dangerous. She continues to say that the man wants her car and demands her car keys, to which she replies, "You gotta be kidding." So chances are that this man could overpower Diane, but instead of pushing her out of the way and grabbing the keys, she says he moved past her and begins to shoot the kids. Now, I have to say that this sounds like an implausible priority. Why shoot the kids first? They pose no threat to the culprit. They're asleep. Why not shoot and kill Diane, who's the one standing in the way of the shooter and the car anyway? He could always get rid of the kids later. Diane claims that she tries to fight the shooter off and feigns throwing the keys into the grass. The culprit then shoots her and runs off after them. At that point, she climbs back in her car and drives off, quote unquote, as fast as she could. The district attorney assigns prosecutor Fred Hughey to the case. Now, at this point, since they don't have any information, they are essentially feeling bad for Diane. Fred Hughey arrives at the hospital to discuss the case with the detectives, and he gets there as the doctors are letting Diane know that Cheryl has passed away. Diane doesn't shed one single tear. She doesn't sound very moved by the loss of her child, and she just wasn't convincing anyone. She then asks about Christy. The doctor lets her know that she is in critical condition and that she will be out of surgery very soon. Now, very quickly, I want to mention that Diane did react to the part when doctor said that she was in critical condition. There definitely was more emotion than there was when she heard about Cheryl, which is so sad to me. The only thing is that she responded to the fact that Christy was still alive. Think about it. She's the oldest. If she comes to, Diane has a great possibility of being found out. Okay, so they let her know about Christy, and this calloused monster asks, "Is there going to be any brain damage? I don't want you to sustain her life if she's going to be a vegetable." I pumped the brakes on this one. Any mother who truly loved her children wouldn't want the doctors to just give up. That's ridiculous. They would want everything possible to be done in order to keep these children alive or this child alive. The doctors are unnerved by her indifferent demeanor and go on to tell her that Danny is in stable condition, but that the bullet has entered a fraction of an inch to the right of his spinal column, which means that there is a possibility that he was not able or would not be able to walk again. Diane apathetically asks, "It missed his heart?" And she became shortly pensive. Now, this really made me wonder if his heart was exactly where she meant to put the bullet. She almost sounded disappointed. So the doctor lets Diane know that he's going to have a surgeon look at her arm. And as he's walking away, Diane asks, "Can I go to work tomorrow?" Everybody looks at her like, "This bitch, did she just say what I think she said? I mean, going to work. How could she think of that when the pressing matter is the well-being of her children?" So the surgeon is looking over her arm and he tells her that she would need surgery in about 2 weeks. He also lets her know that her blood pressure and pulse were normal. So if anyone were to have believed that she was in shock maybe, and that's why she wasn't responding to the death of Cheryl and the state of her children, her vitals tell me that she wasn't even suffering internally. She's even giggling about trivial things. So, oh my God, I am so upset by this woman. I truly am. With all of this cycle babble and word vomit Diane is doing, she's clearly suspicious. Hughie knows it. The doctors know it. The detectives know it. This woman is eminently phony and questionable. It's written all over everyone's faces. Hughie goes see the kids, and as he watches them laying there, he just falls in complete love with them. He has a strong need to protect them, and he fears that their mother is the one they're going to need protection from. He just can't fathom how anyone can aim a gun at 3 small children and pull the trigger as many times as this person did. He genuinely cares about these kids, and it's absolutely beautiful. The police and detectives look over Diane's apartment. She's now a suspect after that giant foot she keeps stuffing in her mouth. Detectives say that it looks like she hasn't started unpacking after living there at that residence for a few months now. They claim to have found the rifle and the gun that she did mention in her statement, but they were looking for a .22 caliber handgun. Hughie is 100% on board with believing that Diane is the shooter. He wants a thorough investigation of the crime scene and a video recording of Diane's reenactment, exactly how the shooting happened. He wants her statement set in stone. He's doing everything possible so that she doesn't slip through their fingers. When Hughie enters the apartment, he immediately notices that she has no pictures of the children, but there is a picture of a man that they believe she's dating. His name is Robert Knickerbocker, and we will discuss his situation with her in a moment. The detective shows Hughie Diane's diary, which contains letters to Mr. Knickerbocker. She claims how much she loves him, how much she loves her children, especially in the last few pages. And there are some articles on surrogate mothers. Now, they did notice that she has 3 kids and there is absolutely no food in the fridge. That is very disconcerting if you ask me. They also find bullet casings in her bedroom and they take it into evidence because they closely resemble that of a .22 caliber, which is what they're looking for. This could potentially solve the case. On one of his visits to the hospital, Hughie officially introduces himself to Diane. He kind of remains at a distance, just observing her. She immediately mentions her diary. I feel as though she wanted them to find it. In the last few pages, she mentions how much she loves her children, how much fun they were having. Of course, she did mention her lover, Robert Knickerbocker. And as the detectives were kind of asking a little bit about him, she says that she doesn't want them to get him involved because he hates hassles. Of course he's not going to want any friction. He doesn't want his wife to find out about their extramarital relationship. As I mentioned before, Diane did say this was the love of her life. She explains how they met and that he was supposed to go live with her and leave his wife, but that he never shows up. And she also goes on to say that her children were just devastated that he didn't show up. Moments later, Steve, her ex-husband, arrives at the hospital. And even though he's not breaking down, he does show a bit more compassion than Diane had. He looks genuine when he's talking to the detectives. And so they pull him out of the room so that they can ask him a few more questions. At that moment, as soon as he steps out of the room, Christy opens her eyes. She opens her eyes and looks directly at Hughie. Once they're safely outside of the room, the detective asks Steve a couple of more questions, which is protocol. His demeanor is pretty calm, he's cooperative, and he also has an alibi. The detective asks if Diane has any guns, to which Steve responds with, yeah, she has three, a rifle, a .30 revolver, and lo and behold, a .22 Ruger. Immediately, Hughie asks if she knew how to shoot the gun, and Steve confirmed that she did because he was the one who taught her. He taught her himself. Steve mentions that he did show her how to maneuver the clip. He does state that he figured she still had the gun because it's gone. He mentioned that the last time that he saw her with the gun was about 6 months ago, and that was a day he would never forget. He explains that she had gotten really upset because Steve would not fix her stereo until they were back together. She was aggressive and showed Steve the gun. She told him not to be home when she got back. Steve tries to get in the car to take the gun from her, but she drives off, and Steve is still hanging off the open door. Meanwhile, the kids are out there screaming, scared. Steve finally lets go and rolls a good distance. His children comfort him while Diane laughs at him uncontrollably. Steve says that the police show up and it's dismissed because they're always fighting. They're always breaking up and then getting back together. Now, until this point, I thought Steve just had the patience of an angel. But after I heard him say the following, I realized that he was either blindly in love or too far short of a happy meal. He was there for her when she was having problems with her boyfriend. Steve, honey, wherever you are out there, I hope that you found someone you love, someone who loves you back in a healthy way that allows you to have peace and harmony. Okay, moving on. Diane leaves her hospital room in the middle of the night, and she tells the detective who was sitting right outside her door that she was headed to see her children. He said he would accompany her, and of course, claiming that it was to protect her, but I'm sure on the inside, he's thinking, bitch, I need to make sure you're not going to hurt your kids. Now, she inappropriately asks, are you married? To which he says he is. Diane then says glumly, that's too bad. I'm going to need someone to be with when this is over. Now, I'm going to need a quick timeout for this one. And I'm back. Now, was she implying that she would need a sexual soothing for comfort? Was she implying that her children will die? Or am I kind of just overthinking this? But come on, would you really put this past her? When Diane gets to the children in the hospital, Hughie and his wife are already watching them. Diane goes straight to Danny and Hughie follows her. He's just watching her like a hawk. Maybe she was uncomfortable with his proximity, so she goes over to Christy. The moment she begins to whisper into her ear, that heart monitor goes berserk. Diane leans in to kiss her, and the closer she gets, the faster the readings are. Diane then leaves the room without any concern for Christy's well-being or questioning why the machine was even going crazy like that. Like an actual caring mother, she didn't even pretend to care. Once Diane leaves the room, Christy opens her eyes frantically. She's breathing frantically even. Looking around the room, her eyes are filled with tears. And once she sees Hughie, her vitals start to normalize. The next day, they're contemplating as to whether there even is a criminal with bushy hair, as Diane had described the culprit. They were wondering, does he even exist? They bring up the same question that I had posed earlier. Why did he not shoot Diane, who was the one who could have identified him? Nothing adds up. The detectives feel like it's a done case. So while the detectives are feeling like this is a done deal, case closed, Hughie asks them this question, which he knows the defense is going to ask as well. Why would Diane shoot herself, shoot her children, and drive them to the hospital? They don't have any insurance on them. What did she have to gain? What was the motive? Hughie decides that it's time to speak to Knickerbocker and anyone else that Diane may have mentioned in her diary. Knickerbocker brings his wife to the interrogation room. The detective kind of wanted to see if she needed to be out of the room to avoid any discomfort, but Knickerbocker had claimed that he had already come clean to her, so he wanted her to stay. So, beginning to talk about Diane, he says that they met in 1981. They were letter carriers together. She was pregnant with her surrogate child. And Hughie had this look like, WTF? After she had the baby, that's when Knickerbocker says that their affair started. He let her know that he had a vasectomy and he never wanted children. He states that he loved his wife, he tried to break it off, and wanted to be with his wife only, but he could never get away from her. As they were about to have intercourse at one point, on one of his visits, he's hesitant to do anything in case the kids walk in. She reassures him that they're elsewhere, and they wouldn't be coming home anytime soon. She's making plans that involve them too, only them two, and that the kids would be with the sitter, no problem. He tells her he loves his wife, but in the heat of the moment, they couldn't stop the erotic momentum. As always, though, Diane is yapping her mouth, telling him he doesn't have to be a daddy, she just wants his love and for him to take care of her. Knickerbocker states that he does not have a gun, he doesn't own one. He does have an alibi. He was with his friends at a bar called Suds till about midnight. He claims that there were plenty of witnesses if they were assuming maybe he did it. He did confirm that Diane had a .22 Ruger, which he saw in the trunk of her car the night that she left for Oregon. Robert Knickerbocker then made the statement, the haunting statement. She shot her kids. I just know she did. Prosecutor Hughie is being updated by the doctor about how the children are doing. She lets him know that Christy did suffer a stroke on the right side of her brain, and this was probably due to the immense loss of blood, and that's affected her entire side, including her left arm, which is now paralyzed. Another thing that was difficult to explain was that she could no longer speak, but because she was at a young age, she may be able to reprogram her vocal cords to allow her to speak. She did mention that Christy was traumatized, but that over time, she may be able to tell them who the shooter was, because she had a feeling that she knew who shot her. she wasn't sure how long it was going to take for her to be able to express anything, but she was willing to work with her. She also told him that with little Danny, there was absolutely no change. In an interview with Steve, he says that Danny was not his son. Diane, throughout their marriage, had accused Steve of stepping out on her. So when they divorced and she was pregnant with their child, and this was after Cheryl, she had aborted it. The guilt Diane had after she made that decision also made her want to replace the child. So according to Steve, she went through a lot of guys at the post office and finally ended up pregnant with Danny. So Hughie brought the conversation back to the gun, the Ruger. Steve tells that she has fired it. In fact, she tried to be a surrogate mother again at one point. She was flown to Kentucky, but it didn't stick. He was the one who met her on the way back, and she was irate. She expected Knickerbocker to pick her up. When they get home, Diane threatened that she would kill herself. Locked in a room, Steve tried to calm her down. Then he heard the gun go off. He kicks the door open to find that she's only shot the roof. And of course she turns the gun to him. I guess he starts wearing her down, and then she starts making the problem into how Knickerbocker was not there for her. So immediately this makes Hughie realized that there's a bullet hole in the bathroom of the trailer. And at the same time, it's hitting Steve suddenly that the officials had a suspect. And it's his volatile ex-wife. He just couldn't believe it. The next and terrifying hindrance was that this barbarous and damaged savage was about to be released from the hospital. How are they going to protect the children now? What would she do to them if she has them altered herself? Would she take them somewhere out of reach? This was an extreme priority for them. And now that the seed has been planted in Steve's head about how Diane may have been the murderer, he's no longer holding his tongue. He begins to question her motive for being out with them so late, which he also found strange. Why she was stopping to help a stranger, which put the kids in danger. The argument did escalate, and Steve had to be escorted out of the room. As he's outside the room, he does let her know that the police are essentially snooping around and suspicious of her, especially when it has to do with the famous Ruger. At Cheryl's funeral, Diane walks in as comfortable as if she was just going to Sunday church. She gets to the casket and she feigns a little weakness and loses her footing ever so slightly. Then she places a rose on Cheryl's chest. This lady, this monster, is too calm for a mother in mourning. There is nothing, there are no characteristics that she is displaying that shows that she even gives a shit about what is happening right in front of her. For those in the room who knew the truth, it was completely disheartening. When she leaves the funeral home, reporters surround her, and of course, like the giant ham that she is, she all but jumps at the chance for this attention.